A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the actual logistics of a phone call between world leaders. The image we all have, a president just grabbing a cell phone and dialing another head of state, that's basically fiction. What he wants to know is the real process. How is the call scheduled? How is it secured? And how many people are actually listening in on what we imagine is a private conversation?
The short answer is, it's a lot of people. The private conversation between two world leaders is about as private as a wedding ceremony with a full videography crew. But the mechanics of how we got here, how the infrastructure actually works, that's genuinely fascinating stuff that almost nobody outside the diplomatic corps ever thinks about.
Which is exactly the kind of thing we love digging into. So let's start with the very first step. A president wants to talk to a prime minister. What actually happens?
What happens is the president tells someone, usually the National Security Advisor or the Chief of Staff, who then contacts the White House Situation Room. The Situation Room has what's called a duty officer, a person who is literally on duty 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, whose job includes fielding exactly this kind of request. That duty officer then sends what's called a call request through diplomatic channels.
A call request? Like booking a conference room.
Essentially, except the conference room is international relations. The request goes through the State Department's Operations Center, which is the diplomatic equivalent of the Situation Room, and from there it goes to the U Embassy in the other country, or directly to the Foreign Ministry of that country. The message itself travels over something called the Diplomatic Telecommunications Service, or DTS, which is a dedicated global network of fiber, satellite links, and encrypted routers that connects all U embassies and consulates. It's not email. It's not a phone call about a phone call. It's a formal diplomatic cable.
We're already at step one, and there's a whole dedicated global network involved before anyone has even picked up a handset.
That's just the U. The receiving country has its own mirror infrastructure. The request lands at their foreign ministry, their equivalent of the Situation Room, and then it gets routed to the leader's office. The two sides then negotiate a time. This can take hours or days depending on time zones, schedules, and the urgency of whatever crisis prompted the call.
What if it's urgent? Can you fast-track this?
For an urgent call, the duty officer can mark the request as flash or immediate precedence, which means it jumps to the front of every queue. Even then, you're looking at maybe 30 to 60 minutes minimum to get both leaders to secure locations with the right personnel in place. A truly emergency call, say during an active military confrontation, can be arranged in under 15 minutes, but that requires both sides to have what's called a pre-coordinated channel. Basically, a standing agreement that says, if we send the flash message on this specific circuit, both leaders will be pulled into their respective SCIFs immediately.
That's the secure room, right?
Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility. It's a room that's been physically hardened against electronic surveillance. The walls are shielded, often with copper mesh or conductive materials to block radio frequency emissions. The windows, if there are any, have special treatments. The power and data lines are filtered. Everything inside is inspected for bugs. When a president takes a secure call, they're not doing it from the Oval Office desk. They're going into a SIF, which, in the White House complex, means either the Situation Room itself or one of the secure communication suites nearby.
The president physically moves to a special room just to take a phone call.
And it's the same for the other leader. They each have their own SIF. In some countries, the prime minister might have a CIF in their residence, but typically they need to be at their office or a military facility. The physical infrastructure alone is a massive constraint on how these calls happen.
Let's talk about the actual phone. What does the president pick up?
Not an iPhone. What they pick up is a secure terminal. Historically, the U used something called the STU-3, the Secure Telephone Unit, third generation, which looked like a chunky beige office phone from the 1980s, but with a crypto ignition key slot. the user would insert a physical key, kind of like a thick credit card with a chip, which contained the cryptographic keys. That key would authenticate the call and enable the encryption.
A physical key? So you could literally lock and unlock the ability to make secure calls?
Lose the key. No secure calls. The STU-3 was eventually replaced by the STE, the Secure Terminal Equipment, which looked more like a modern office phone with a display screen, but the principle was the same. These days, the U uses something called Secure Voice over IP, or SVoIP, which runs over classified IP networks rather than traditional phone lines. The calls are encrypted with AES 256 or stronger, and the voice data travels as encrypted packets over dedicated fiber lines that are physically separate from the public internet.
AES 256. That's the same encryption standard that banks use, but presumably with additional layers.
Multiple additional layers. The encryption is end-to-end, meaning the voice is encrypted at the president's handset and isn't decrypted until it reaches the other leader's handset. But the network itself is also encrypted at the transport layer, and the physical lines are often buried, pressurized, and monitored for tampering. If someone tries to tap the fiber, the pressure change is detected immediately.
We've got a scheduled time. Two SIFs, encrypted handsets, dedicated fiber lines. The president sits down. What happens next?
An operator patches the call through. There is literally a person, usually a military or civilian technician from the White House Communications Agency, known as WHCA, who sits at a switchboard and physically connects the call. The president picks up the handset, hears a dial tone or a direct connection to the operator, and the operator says something like, "Mr. President, I have Prime Minister Netanyahu on the secure line." Then they connect.
There's a switchboard operator, like a 1940s telephone exchange, but for nuclear-armed heads of state.
The technology is more advanced, but the human role is exactly the same. The WHCA employs over 1,000 personnel, by the way. Their entire job is presidential communications, phones, radios, video teleconferencing, everything. When the president travels, WHCA travels with them, setting up secure communications at every stop.
1,000 people, just to make sure the president can make a phone call.
It costs real money. A typical secure phone call between leaders runs thousands of dollars per hour when you factor in the dedicated infrastructure, the personnel on both ends, the encryption systems, the interpreters, the transcription. This is not a cheap operation.
All right, so the operator connects the call. The two leaders are on the line. Who else is listening?
This is where the numbers get surprising. The absolute minimum is probably 6 people, the two leaders, obviously. Then you need interpreters, at least one per side, often two. Then you need note-takers, at least one per side, usually a State Department or National Security Council staffer whose entire job is to produce a verbatim transcript. That's 6 people right there.
6 people minimum for what we imagine as a private conversation.
That's the floor. In practice, it's often more. You might have a senior advisor in the room listening on a headset or a speaker. The WHCA operator is on the line monitoring audio quality and connection integrity. There might be an intelligence officer listening to ensure nothing classified is being inadvertently exposed. Each leader's security detail is in the SCIF, and while they're not officially on the call, they can hear it.
We're not talking about 6 people. We're talking about maybe 10, 12, 15 people hearing every word.
And every single one of them has security clearance. The room itself is a CIF, so everyone in it is cleared. The interpreters are cleared, the note-takers are cleared, the operators are cleared. This is one of the most tightly controlled environments in government.
Let's talk about the interpreters, because that adds a whole other layer of complexity. If the American president doesn't speak the other leader's language, how does the conversation actually flow?
The president speaks a sentence or two, pauses, and the interpreter translates into the other language. Then the other leader responds in their language, pauses, and their interpreter translates into English. This means a 30-minute call might contain only 15 minutes of actual leader-to-leader dialogue. The rest is translation.
It's not a fluid conversation. It's staccato.
Very much so. And the interpreters aren't just translating words, they're translating tone, nuance, diplomatic phrasing. A good interpreter can convey that a statement was deliberately ambiguous or that a particular word choice was significant. The interpreters are often diplomats themselves or at least deeply familiar with the diplomatic register of both languages.
Each side brings their own interpreter, presumably so they can trust the translation.
You never rely on the other side's interpreter alone. Each leader has their own interpreter in the room, and often the interpreters are listening to each other as much as they're listening to the leaders. If the other side's interpreter softens a threat or hardens a compliment, your interpreter will flag that immediately, either in real time or in the post-call debrief.
The interpreters are also a verification mechanism.
They're a diplomatic layer in their own right. And here's a detail most people don't think about. The interpreters are often the first people to know when a relationship between leaders is deteriorating. They hear the tone shift before the note takers write it down, before the transcripts are analyzed, before the pundits speculate. The interpreters are the canaries in the diplomatic coal mine.
What about the note takers? What are they actually producing?
A verbatim transcript. Every official call is recorded. The White House switchboard records all secure line calls automatically. But the note taker's job is to produce the official written record. This isn't just transcription. The note taker is annotating who spoke, at what time, in what tone, with what apparent intent. The transcript is then classified, typically at the secret or top secret level, and stored in the presidential record system.
There's an audio recording and a written transcript, both classified.
The audio recording is the primary record, but the transcript is what gets circulated within the government. The president's national security team reads the transcript, not the audio. The transcript becomes the basis for policy decisions, follow-up actions, and sometimes, eventually, the historical record.
This is where we get into the famous examples. The Trump-Zelensky call in 2019, where the transcript was actually released.
That transcript showed exactly this structure. The back and forth with interpreters, the formal diplomatic phrasing, the note taker's annotations. People who read it expecting a casual chat were surprised by how structured it was. But that's how all these calls work. They're diplomatic events, not phone calls in the everyday sense.
Then there was the Trump-Putin-Helsinki meeting in 2018, where the reporting afterwards suggested there was no American note-taker present during the leader's private conversation, which caused a whole separate controversy.
That was a face-to-face meeting, not a phone call, but the principle is the same. When you don't have a note-taker, there's no official you record of what was said. The only record is the president's own recollection and whatever the other side chooses to share. That's why the note-taker role exists. It's an institutional safeguard.
If you're a leader and you want to say something truly off the record, you basically can't on these calls.
You really can't. And leaders are briefed on this before every call. There's a pre-brief where advisors go through the agenda, the talking points, the red lines, the things to avoid saying. And there's a post-brief where they review what was actually said and plan follow-ups. The call itself is the middle of a sandwich of preparation and analysis.
The pre-brief is basically, here's what you're allowed to say, and here's what you absolutely cannot say.
Here's what the other leader is likely to bring up. Here's their domestic political situation. Here's what they're sensitive about. Here's where they might try to trap you. The pre-brief is a full intelligence product. It draws on diplomatic reporting, signals intelligence, open source analysis, everything.
The president isn't just winging it. They're walking in with a briefing book.
A thick one. And the call itself is often timed. The operator knows the scheduled duration, and if there's a security issue, a line drop, an encryption failure, anything that compromises the integrity of the call, the operator can terminate it immediately.
Has that actually happened?
It's happened in exercises and tests. In real-world calls, encryption failures are rare because the systems are redundant and tested constantly. But the protocol exists. If the secure voice indicator on the handset stops showing green, the call ends.
Let's go back to the infrastructure for a moment. You mentioned the red phone earlier. That's the famous hotline between Washington and Moscow. But it was never actually a phone.
Never a phone. It was established in 1963 after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it was a teletype machine. The reasoning was that voice communication could be misunderstood in a crisis. Tone, emotion, mistranslation. So they wanted written messages that could be carefully composed and precisely translated. The hotline was a dedicated undersea cable and later a satellite link with teletype terminals at both ends.
So the most famous phone in history was a text messaging system.
The original text messaging system for nuclear crisis management. It's been upgraded over the decades. It's now a secure computer link with email, like capabilities. But the principle remains the same. Written, deliberate, verifiable communication.
Which kind of undermines the whole Hollywood image of the president grabbing a red phone and shouting into it.
The red phone was a prop in movies. The real thing was a printer clattering away in the Pentagon.
Now, you mentioned earlier that modern calls use secure voice over IP. What's the actual technical stack there? What does WHCA physically do to make the call happen?
The modern S-VoIP system runs on classified networks like JWICS, the Joint Worldwide Intelligence Communications System, or CyberNet, the secret Internet Protocol router network. These are physically separate from the public internet. They have their own fiber, their own routers, their own everything. The voice data is packetized, encrypted with AES 256 or higher, and transmitted over these dedicated networks. The handset itself is essentially a specialized computer that handles the encryption and the voice codec.
The audio quality.
Early secure voice systems had terrible audio. The encryption would compress the voice into something almost robotic. Modern systems use wideband codecs that preserve natural voice quality. You can hear tone, inflection, even the person's breathing. It sounds like a normal phone call, which is important because leaders need to read each other's emotional state.
The technology has gotten good enough that the encryption is invisible to the user.
The president picks up the handset, hears a normal dial tone, and talks normally. All the complexity, the encryption, the network routing, the anti-tamper monitoring happens underneath.
Let's talk about what happens when things go wrong. You mentioned the 2021 incident with Joseph Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief. His call with the Afghan leadership was reportedly intercepted.
That was a stark reminder of why all this infrastructure exists. Borrell was reportedly using a non-secure or insufficiently secure line, and the call was intercepted, possibly by Russian intelligence, though the exact attribution is still debated. The contents leaked, and it was embarrassing for the EU. It showed that if you skip the CIF, skip the encrypted handset, skip the dedicated network, you are essentially broadcasting your conversation to anyone with the capability to intercept it.
That's the trade-off, right? Speed versus security. A cell phone call is instant, but it's trivially interceptable. A secure call takes hours to arrange, but is essentially uninterceptable.
For heads of state, the calculation is almost always security over speed, unless it's a genuine emergency where minutes matter. Even then, they have prearranged secure channels that can be activated quickly.
The idea of a president impulsively calling another leader, that basically doesn't happen.
It really doesn't. The scheduling process alone makes it impossible. And even if a president wanted to, the staff would intervene. The National Security Advisor would say, "Sir, we need to set this up properly." The protocol exists precisely to prevent impulsive, unrecorded, unsecured communication between nuclear-armed powers.
The protocol is the guardrail.
And it's not just American protocol. Every nuclear-armed state, and frankly every state with a functioning diplomatic corps, has similar procedures. The Russians have their own SCIFs, their own encrypted networks, their own interpreters. The Chinese have an elaborate system. The Indians, the Pakistanis, any pair of countries where a miscommunication could be catastrophic has invested in this infrastructure.
We've covered the scheduling, the security, the room, the interpreters, the note-takers. What's the total headcount on a typical call?
If I had to give a realistic estimate, I'd say 8 to 15 people are hearing the conversation in real time. Two leaders, 2 to 4 interpreters, 2 note-takers, 1 or 2 operators monitoring the line, possibly a senior advisor on each side, and security personnel in the room. And then, after the call, the transcript gets circulated to a wider circle. National security staff, relevant cabinet members, sometimes ambassadors. So the audience grows over time.
15 people listening to what the public imagines is a private chat between 2 people.
Every one of those people has a job. The interpreters are translating and verifying. The note takers are documenting. The operators are monitoring. The advisor is analyzing in real time, sometimes passing notes to the leader. The call is a production.
That's exactly the right word. It's a staged, scripted, monitored, recorded, transcribed, and analyzed event.
With a pre-brief and a post-brief. It's closer to a diplomatic meeting than a phone call. The phone is just the medium.
Okay, So let's get practical. For someone listening who's not a head of state but who deals with sensitive information, a journalist, a lawyer, a business executive, what should they take away from this?
The core principle is that standard phone lines are not secure, not even a little bit. If you're discussing something sensitive, you need end-to-end encryption at minimum. Signal, WhatsApp with verified safety numbers, or dedicated secure VoIP systems. And for truly sensitive conversations, you need to think about the physical environment too. Are you in a room where someone could overhear? Is your device compromised? The diplomatic world goes to extreme lengths for a reason.
The second takeaway is about process. The reason these calls are so structured isn't just security. It's about creating a reliable record and preventing miscommunication. In any high-stakes conversation, having a shared understanding of what was said is critical.
Which is why I always recommend sending a brief summary email after any important verbal conversation. Here's what I understood we agreed to. It's the civilian equivalent of the note-taker's transcript.
The diplomatic protocol, translated into email etiquette.
It's not paranoia, it's clarity.
Let's look forward. You mentioned quantum computing potentially breaking current encryption. What does that mean for these secure calls in the future?
It's a real concern. AES-256 is quantum resistant to some degree. Grover's algorithm would effectively halve the key length to 128 bits, which is still secure. But the key exchange mechanisms that set up the encryption could be vulnerable. Government is already migrating to post-quantum cryptographic algorithms. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, has been standardizing quantum-resistant algorithms, and the expectation is that secure voice systems will adopt these within the next decade.
The encryption arms race continues.
It never stops. And on the other side, there's the question of AI-powered translation. If real-time AI translation gets good enough, does it replace human interpreters? I think the answer is no, at least for the foreseeable future, because the interpreter's role isn't just translation. It's diplomatic analysis, nuance detection, verification. An AI can translate words. It can't tell you that the other leader's tone shifted in a way that suggests they're about to walk away from the negotiation.
The human ear for subtext is still the critical sensor.
Probably will be for a long time. But I could see AI being used as a supplementary tool, providing real-time transcription, flagging inconsistent statements, cross-referencing with previous calls. The note-taker of the future might have an AI assistant that highlights discrepancies as they happen.
The call of the future might have even more listeners. Just some of them will be machines.
The 15 people in the room, plus a few AI agents. The private conversation keeps getting less private.
All right, I want to circle back to one thing. The famous red phone, the Washington-Moscow hotline. You said it was a teletype. When did it actually become a voice line?
It didn't, really. The hotline has always been a text-based system. It was upgraded to satellite in the 1970s and then to a secure fiber optic link in the 2000s, but it's always been for written messages. There is a separate secure voice link between the White House and the Kremlin that was established later, but it's not the hotline. The hotline is specifically the text system for crisis communication.
The red phone, in every movie and TV show, is a complete fiction. It's a text messaging system that's been running for over 60 years.
The actual terminals are in the Pentagon, not the White House. The president wouldn't even be the one typing. The message would be composed by the National Security Team, approved by the president, and transmitted by a duty officer. It's about as far from grab the red phone as you can get.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. The most important communication channel in human history. And it's essentially a secure Slack.
A secure Slack with exactly two users and the highest stakes imaginable. I love that description.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Take it away, Hilbert.
Korean speech levels include a complex system of honorifics with seven distinct tiers, ranging from intimate plain form to formal deferential. A common misconception attributes the origin of this system to a 7th century Silla Kingdom decree, but linguistic evidence actually traces the formalization of Korean honorifics to interactions with Ainu traders on Sakhalin Island centuries earlier, where cross-cultural politeness conventions influenced the development of the elaborate speech level system.
You're right. Here's the thing I keep thinking about. We've spent this whole episode describing a system designed to make communication between leaders as secure, deliberate, and documented as possible. And yet the entire apparatus exists because the stakes of miscommunication are so catastrophically high. One mistranslated word, one impulsive remark, one intercepted call, and you've got an international crisis.
The infrastructure isn't just about technology. It's a buffer against human fallibility. Every layer, the scheduling delay, the pre-brief, the interpreters, the note-takers, the recording, is designed to slow things down and inject deliberation into what could otherwise be a dangerously impulsive medium.
The phone call as a medium is inherently impulsive. You speak, the other person responds. The whole infrastructure is designed to make it less like a phone call and more like a diplomatic meeting.
Yet they still use voice, because voice conveys something that text doesn't. Tone, emotion, sincerity, resolve. You can't get that from a cable. The voice call occupies this strange middle ground between the immediacy of speech and the deliberation of written diplomacy.
Which is probably why it survived, despite all the complexity and cost. There's no substitute for hearing another leader's voice.
No, there isn't. And as long as that's true, there will be SCIFs and interpreters and WHCA operators and all the invisible machinery that makes those calls possible. The private conversation between two leaders will never actually be private. And honestly, that's probably for the best.
If you've got a weird prompt, something you've always wondered about how the world actually works behind the scenes, send it to us at My Weird Prompts. We love this stuff.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. We'll be back with another one soon.
Catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.